I slide my hand down the back pocket of my favorite jean shorts and feel the familiar sensation of paper between my fingers. I smile. I've read this receipt 100 times. I know it off by heart, and yet I can't resist but read it once more. Nautilus Restaurant. Order taken by Pratika. June 15th, 2011, at 9:32 a.m. Super breakfast. And there it is. Her signature at the bottom. Her writing with all its nuance. Her hand made those letters. It says the same old thing, although now it is much harder to read. It continues to yellow, the paper thins and the text fades. I squeeze myself into these itty-bitty jean shorts that belonged to Sam. And every time I hold that delicate receipt in my hand, I remember she was real. She was a real person who went places and did things and bought things that required receipts. She was real. And this tiny piece of scrappy paper proves it. As a child, I remember sitting in front of the TV watching reruns of The Nanny. In between Fran Vine's squawking and Mr. Sheffield spawning my attraction to avoidant men were commercials for bananananananas, Furbies, and cancer statistics. 1 in 3 people you meet will get cancer at some stage of their lives. A scary male voice decreed into living rooms across Australia. I felt guilty because I wasn't scared and I didn't really care. Mostly, I was thinking about how unfair it was that my school friend Elsa was allowed a Furby and I wasn't because my parents thought they were creepy. Looking back, I'm pretty sure Furbies fed on the nightmares of children, so it was probably a good call. Nicholas Sparks' film adaptations would teach me that The Sick Girl is a starring role. So, when I was diagnosed with a spinal tumour at 21, the fantasy I created in my mind had me picturing something like this. In my delusion, I would lay draped weakly over a chaise longue, one hand to my forehead, the other falling by my wayside, as he, the infamous faceless he, held my hand and read to me from one of my favourite books. Whilst on the verge of death, he would ask for my hand in marriage, and as a single tear ran lamely down my cheek, I would choke out, "Yes." Now, having lived a rather different experience, I am quite sure old Nikki Sparks has never, not once, been around a sick young woman. Because in reality, it looks more like this. There, I would lay slumped, clammy, and pale with a greenish tinge in my bed. My skin damp with sweat from the oxycontin and morphine seeping from my pores. My cold hands filled with drips and needles that he is too afraid to disturb go unheld for weeks. I notice, but say nothing, planting the first seed of resentment that my fairy tale has been dismissed. Rather than ask for my hand in marriage, he asks if we really must watch another episode of Ready, Steady, Cook, to which my reply is a forceful yes, as tears of frustration fall from my face, now red with fury. At 22, I attended a wellness cancer retreat in the country. Between the 3 times daily meditation sessions and 7 cold-pressed vegetable juices we were made to drink, we enjoyed workshops ranging from what would you do if you had 3 months to live, a reality for many people in there, to how to perform an at-home coffee enema. As dedicated as I was, this was a practice difficult to look forward to, and I decided to pull the plug early on, so to speak. In the midst of all of this depressing lunacy, I met Sam. Sam, who brought three pairs of sparkly slippers to alternate over the two-week stay. Sam, who brought her iPad to watch downloaded episodes of Long Island Medium before bed. Sam, who brought a forbidden array of nuts, lollies and chocolates to illegally snack on and offered them to me like someone selling stolen watches in a duster down a dark alley. Sam, my best friend. She wasn't wearing a stitch of makeup, but her Mediterranean skin glowed, making her chocolate brown eyes sparkle. She was petite in stature, but took up space unapologetically. Looking at her made me inadvertently lift my chest and tuck my shoulders back a little, trying to emulate her confidence. Her short, dark hair was pulled back from her face by a headscarf, which I would later learn was covering an impressive scar on her skull. We were the two youngest people attending Camp Cancer by at least 20 years, and as such, we clung to each other for dear life. To this day, she is the coolest person I've ever known. It was always effortless for her. Even with a terminal brain tumor, she was sunshine personified. And she had chosen me to be her friend. Being seen by Sam, realizing she really wanted to know me, is probably the most important I've felt in my entire life. What people often forget about cancer is that you can look normal, healthy even, for quite a while, right up until you don't. It's easy to forget that you're watching someone you love slowly die. What the movies don't show is the process of the body beginning to shut down, first in subtle ways that are easy to miss if you're not watching closely. Your loved one becomes weak, tired, and their once ravenous appetite is now bird-like and scarce. This goes on until one day you see your friend, who you remember jumping off boats in string bikinis, dancing on tables with you at clubs, and crying with laughter at your jokes, struggle to understand simple concepts. Her breathing labored and appearance very different from the cancer patients you were shown on film. You catch yourself struggling to recognize your friend in the face staring back at you, focusing on her eyes. She's still in the eyes. On the 8th of November, 2015, I sat by her bedside gently clasping her swollen hand. It was my 27th birthday. I remember the final time I got to tell Sam I loved her. I was talking to her, telling her how beautiful she was and giving her a gentle kiss on her forehead. I remember the freckles lining her nose and the weight of her plump cheeks in my hands, swollen from the steroids. She could no longer speak, and the muscles in her face and eyes were too tired to function. Her eyes welled up as I spoke, and I noticed the tiniest amount of tension visible between her brow. Her brow softened, and she closed her eyes. My heart broke. We lost her 4 days later, when she was just 31. I was down the hall of the hospital when I got the news. All I remember is this guttural scream bursting free of my chest as another group of hospital visitors looked on. I tried to stand up to run to her bedside, but my legs buckled beneath me. I fell to my knees as my boyfriend Simon weakly patted my shoulder. "There, there." Sam's courageous friend Alana flew down the corridor and scooped me up from the hospital floor. I buried my face in her cushiony chest and sobbed. She held me, rocking my shocked, limp body as Simon shuffled awkwardly in his seat. We don't talk about friends as life partners much. We put all that pressure on romantic love. But that's what Sam was to me. She was my soulmate. She made me better, happier. The strange thing about losing your closest friend is that they are the only person you want to talk to about it. It doesn't make any sense. But the minute I found out Sam was gone, I took out my phone to call her and tell her the news. I wanted her to tell me I would be okay, even if she didn't believe it. I wanted to tell her how useless Simon had been and hear her chuckle at his emotional incompetence before telling me to dump his sorry ass. But all I got when I called her phone was her iconic answering message. "Hi, you've called Sam. I'm either sleeping, meditating, or can't be bothered talking. So please leave a message and I'll get back to you."